Doe versus U.S. Okay, Ms. Landau, when you're ready.
May it please the court. This case presents three constitutional challenges to the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act, or SORNA. The first is that Congress exceeded its powers under the Commerce Clause when it enacted SORNA. Second, that the Attorney General did not comply with Congress's directive to notify sex offenders like Mr. Letourneau of their duty to register. Third, that Congress delegated the decision of who SORNA would apply to the Attorney General in violation of the separation of powers. In 2004, Mr. Letourneau was convicted in Tennessee of attempted aggravated sexual battery. On July 27, 2006, Congress passed SORNA, the purpose of which was to, quote, establish a comprehensive national system for the registration of sex offenders, end quote, to protect the public thereby. The Act then goes on to list 17 intrastate offenses that it would like to have prevented. Congress delegated the responsibility of determining whether SORNA would apply retroactively to people like Mr. Letourneau who were convicted of sex offenses prior to the enactment of SORNA to the Attorney General, and that's in Section 16913D. At the same time, Congress directed the Attorney General to prescribe regulations for those offenders like Mr. Letourneau to notify them of their duty to register, and that's in 16917B. The Attorney General decided that SORNA would apply retroactively in February 2007, but prescribed no regulations to notify those people like Mr. Letourneau of the new federal duty to register. When Mr. Letourneau was released from Tennessee State Prison in June of 2007, he was notified of his duty to register under Tennessee law and to update that registration, but not of the federal duty to register under federal law. The criminal enforcement provision of SORNA at 18 U.S.C. 2250 prohibits knowingly failing to register or update a registration as required by SORNA. Now, we know that knowingly applies not only to failing to register, but failing to register as required by SORNA. That is indicated by the plain text of the statute, as well as the Supreme Court's later decision in Flores-Figueroa in the aggravated identity theft statute.
What difference was there between what he's required to do by Tennessee and what he's required to do by SORNA in practical terms?
In practical terms, there's a difference in terms of the time frame that you have to register under, to update the registration. Under Tennessee law, it's 10 days, and under SORNA, it's 3. The penalties are different. There's a fine and a 90-day plus penalty under the Tennessee statute. Under the federal statute, the maximum is 10 years.
Right. I understand the penalties are different, but as far as the timing, he didn't do either one, did he, 3 or 10?
No, he did not.
And he knew he was supposed to do the Tennessee thing.
He did.
And he didn't do that.
He did not.
Okay.
Well, looking at SORNA, it says you have to, within 3 days, you must appear in person in a jurisdiction. It seems to me that under the facts of this case, he would have been required to report in Texas.
He would have been required by Texas under SORNA to register in Texas.
And I thought there was some admission by him that he knew he was required to report under Texas law. He wasn't sure of the time, but he knew that he was required to report, and he didn't do it.
I think that the admission Your Honor is referring to is in the PSR, and it isn't clear at what point he was aware that he needed to register in Texas because, of course, Detective Martin with the Brownsville Police Department told him that he had to register.
I thought he said during that process, before he was arrested, I knew I was supposed to register under Texas law. I just wasn't sure when.
I'd have to double check the record, but this is also a facial challenge under the Due Process Clause. If it isn't enough to know that he had to register under Texas law or under Tennessee law, he needed to know that he needed to register under federal law, and there's no admission anywhere that he knew that.
But he traveled interstate after the regulation was adopted.
He did, Your Honor. We're not making an ex post facto clause argument. The violation.
Why isn't he imputed with knowledge of what the law is, like everybody else?
Because this is a different case. This is an affirmative duty to do something, not just to refrain from engaging in illegal behavior.
I mean, you're not required to know what the law is if it imposes an affirmative duty on you?
You're not presumed to know what the law is, certainly.
Well, I mean, very few crimes where the government has to prove that he knew that he was violating the law. As long as the law was there and they proved that he did violate it.
Well, it's an unusual statute, Your Honor. I don't know very many statutes that require people to register their status, but the statute does say knowingly fail to register under the federal law. I wanted to finish my answer to Judge Haynes' question about how the two differ. There's also the frequency of reporting and also the length of time that you are expected to report. I believe that encompasses the main differences between the federal and the potential differences between the federal and the state.
Well, what's your best case that either under this statute or some analogous statute that the government must prove knowledge that you're violating the law?
Lambert is probably the best case, and also I would say Flores-Figueroa is also a very good case. In Flores-Figueroa, the Supreme Court concluded that the element of knowingly applied not only to the fraud, but also to the fact that that was really somebody's actual identification. And here, it's almost parallel, not just knowingly failing to register, but knowingly failing to register or update a registration as required by SORNA. So the knowingly applies not only to the failure to act, but the failure to act according to this federal statute. If I could, I'd like to, if the court has no further questions about the due process issue, I'd like to turn to the Commerce Clause. And the Supreme Court in Lopez laid out three means by which Congress can regulate under the Commerce Clause. The first is the use of the channels of interstate commerce, and the idea being to keep the channels free of injurious and immoral use. And an example of that would be the Caminiti case, which dealt with the Mann Act, transporting people interstate for the purpose of prostitution. The second prong is to regulate and protect the instrumentalities of interstate commerce, or persons or things in interstate commerce, even though the threat may come only from intrastate activity.
I didn't get here with my copy of Morris today, but doesn't footnote 5 address this situation? The Supreme Court says, well, there's another part of the Act, the Violence Against Women Act, that deals with the jurisdictional tie if you cross interstate lines. And the court said virtually every circuit court has upheld that.
Is the question whether the jurisdictional tie here takes care of that?
Yes.
It doesn't. And the reason is if you look at the tie, it's extremely weak. There's no link between the interstate travel and an intent to commit an illegal act.
This seems to me that's what the Supreme Court was getting at. And again, I'm just from memory. I think it was footnote 5 in Morse with respect to the Violence Against Women Act.
Well, if I could, I'd like to take a peek at footnote 5 before I fully answer your question. But the jurisdictional hook in this case is substantially weaker than any other statute that this court has addressed, because there's no link to commerce. There is only travel. There's no link between the travel and the illegal act that Congress is purporting to regulate. All a person need do is travel with or without the intent to register and then fail to register. And the court has never upheld such a weak link anywhere. I think it's helpful to look at some of the cases that deal with the second prong. Examples of protecting the instrumentalities would be prohibitions against loan sharking as in the Supreme Court's case in Perez. And there were copious findings about the effect that these loan sharking activities had on legitimate commerce. We have no such findings here about commerce at all. An example of regulating persons or things in interstate commerce would be the prohibition against destruction of aircraft involved in interstate commerce. Other examples, theft of interstate shipments and regulations of railroad safety and railroad rates. All of these things, and they're different from this case, involve commerce. And while someone is in the channel, there is a commercial aspect. It isn't enough that they just travel. They have to be in interstate commerce.
What about the domestic violence statute, which makes it illegal to travel across a state line to injure, harass, or intimidate a spouse?
Yes, that's a great example, Your Honor. There, the travel has an immoral and injurious purpose. It can be regulated under the first prong, like the Mann Act. The travel is linked to the illegal activity. There's no such link here.
Why couldn't Congress have considered it a regulation against immoral conduct to require a sex offender to register in a new state to protect the public?
I don't see the commerce there, respectfully,
Your
Honor.
What's the commerce in traveling interstate to injure a spouse?
Well, there you're using the channel for an immoral purpose. There's no link in SORNA like that.
The channel of commerce takes you from one point A to point B. You don't have to beat your spouse on the trip.
No, but you're using the channel for the purpose of committing violence against.
This man used it to get away from a place where people would know who he is. And I think Judge Davis is saying the point here is to warn the public, you know, don't have your children out playing with this registered sex offender. And if he moves away and doesn't tell anybody who he is, then he evades that.
But the statute doesn't require that he travel with that purpose, and every other jurisdictional hook has that intent element. He could
intent
have
to evade.
Intent to evade. While there is testimony here that Mr. Letourneau told the Tennessee officer that he intended to leave, that is not required by the statute.
I wanted to make sure you addressed Whaley, which you all were very kind to bring to our attention. Is Whaley, whatever the outcome of Whaley is, would that arguably be dispositive of this appeal? I mean, should we await the ruling in Whaley before ruling here?
Well, they're certainly linked. To the extent that the facial challenge is raised here and there, those would be dispositive. And then the third way that Congress can regulate under the Commerce Clause is the substantial effect on interstate commerce, which the government does not contend applies here. The government really relies on the first and second prongs. I think it's just circling back to the interstate violence case. The key here, I think, and why the statute is so far afield of what this court has dealt with before, is that lack of jurisdictional hook. There is travel.
What about possession of a gun that's been transported in interstate commerce?
That's a closer question, Your Honor. There are a couple of differences that I think are worth pointing out. First, various members of this court have indicated that if that issue were to be raised for the first time now, post-Lopez, a different result might occur. That's one. It's a difficult issue. Two, firearms are commodities themselves. They are a commodity that is already very heavily regulated by the federal government. The manufacturer, the transfer, the sale, all of those things are already regulated federally. And then you also have copious findings about the effect that guns have on commerce. Congress made those.
You know, here the government has to show more than just travel. They've got to show a conviction that gives rise to a registration requirement. They've got to show then the travel and then a failure to register. It's not just travel they have to show.
Correct. But with respect to the interstate element, all they have to show is travel. There's no commerce involved. There's no link between the travel and the illegal behavior. You can travel with all the best intentions of registering. you're not misusing the channel. Then when you arrive, for whatever reason, you fail to register within 3 days, as required by SORNA. I think it's helpful to look at Lopez. And in the factors in Lopez that I think apply here, first, it's criminal activity, like Lopez. The jurisdictional element is insufficient, as I just discussed. And here, there were no findings about interstate commerce, which is another factor that really distinguishes SORNA from the other cases that this court has dealt with in the past.
You have any way to distinguish all these circuit cases that disagree with you?
Yes, actually. I would love to do that. The reasoning in these cases is really not up to the standard that this court has set for Commerce Clause issues. A lot of the reasoning is flip at best. For example, in Dixon, the court dispatches the Commerce Clause argument in a sentence because it wasn't raised in the briefing, and it throws out the Mann Act, but then doesn't explain why SORNA involves a misuse of the channels of commerce the way the Mann Act does. I see that my time is up.
Yeah, you can save that for rebuttal. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Berry.
Good morning. May it please the court. Ms. Landau. Richard Berry from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Houston. Let me launch into a response to Ms. Landau's argument as to the due process or notice argument first. Precisely, as Judge Davis noted, Mr. Letourneau's argument to the his as-applied argument and lack of due process notice would be razor thin in this case. He is the poster child for actual substantive notice of a violation. In 1996, he committed a sex offense in Colorado. He was sentenced to 10 years. It was reduced to 8. He served 6. December 2001, he received a written notification from the state of Colorado that he was required to register as a sex offender under Colorado state law. Less than a year later, he was arrested in Virginia and charged with failure to register as a sex offender under Virginia law. He was eventually allowed to plead guilty to obstruction of justice, and he served 240 days. That would be actual notice number 2. Less than 4 months later, he was arrested in Tennessee and charged with, among other things, failure to register under the Tennessee state law requiring registration of sex offenders. That would be actual notice number 3, and we're not actually to the facts of this particular appeal. 2 days prior to his release from prison in Tennessee, in 2007, he was notified by Mr. Sperling from the Tennessee Department of Corrections that he had to note it, that he had to register under Tennessee state law. In fact, he was told first that he had to contact his probation officer within 48 hours of his release from prison, which he subsequently failed to do. Second, he was told that he had to notify the state of Tennessee where he was going to live, where he was going to work, and where he could be reached, which he failed to do. And third, he was told that if he changed his address or his employment, he had to notify the state of Tennessee within 10 days, which he subsequently failed to do. As Judge Haynes noted in one of her questions, there is a slight variance between Colorado, Virginia, Tennessee, Texas, and the SORNA statute in terms of the timing of the reporting. The variance runs from 3 days to 5 days, 3 days under SORNA to 5 days to 7 days to 10 days. In Mr. Letourneau's case, it is uncontested that he was released from the Tennessee State Prison June the 21st. His first contact with any law enforcement authority was when he was arrested August the 3rd, 43 days later. During that period, there was absolutely no attempt to register to update his registration in Tennessee or to contact Texas authorities and register under the Texas State Act. The requirement under SORNA is he knew that he had committed an offense that required sex offender registration. He subsequently traveled in interstate commerce, and then he failed either to register or, in his case, to update his registration with the state of Tennessee.
Well, SORNA requires personal. You have to appear within 3 days personally. So he would either had to have gone back to Tennessee or personally appeared in Texas, I thought.
I believe that you're correct, Your Honor, and I believe the testimony was uncontested that Richard Sperling with the Tennessee Department of Corrections told him on June the 19th, you, Mr. Letourneau, must report to your probation officer, Ms. Irwin Winton, within 48 hours, within 2 days of the time you're released from the Tennessee State Prison System. He was released on June the 21st, and he never once contacted Ms. Irwin Winton or anyone else anywhere in the state of Tennessee in connection with registering as a sex offender. So, whatever the standard, he failed to comply. We don't know where he was from June the 21st until June the 27th. On June the 27th, he appears at a homeless shelter in Brownsville. And when he appears, he is using the name Paul or Pablo Rutherford and a different date of birth, a date of birth not his own. So even if the authorities from Colorado or Virginia or Tennessee or Texas came looking for Tommy Edward Letourneau, registered sex offender, who should have registered in Texas, who should have updated his registration in Tennessee, they would have found Paul Rutherford with a different date of birth. As to the argument that Lambert or Flores Figueroa supports the proposition that he didn't receive proper notice under the Due Process Clause, Lambert would be distinguishable on the basis that there was no mens rea required there. In this case, one must knowingly fail to register or to update registration. In this case, it would be knowingly, and the jury was so instructed. In this case, it would be knowingly failing to update his registration in Tennessee. As a matter of fact, he had no contact with the state of Tennessee after he was released from prison on June the 21st. As to the Commerce Clause argument, I would respectfully disagree with Ms. Landau. The legislative history behind House Bill 3132 provides abundant documentation that Congress was painfully aware of the fact that there are 500,000 sex offenders in the United States as of 2005. At least 100,000 of those people literally drop off the charts because once they're registered, and by the time SORNA was enacted in 2005, each of the 50 states had a state sex offender.
What's the commerce link?
The commerce link in this incident would be travel and interstate commerce, which in and of itself has the effect of removing a sex offender from one jurisdiction and placing him or her in another jurisdiction.
When I looked at Morris, one thing that struck me is the court said, you know, it's abundantly clear that our decision in Lopez was based on commerce, and it's talking about commercial activity. And it quoted Lopez, and Lopez, for the second area, the way that Congress can regulate commerce, it cited three cases. One dealt with railroad rates, one dealt with the Railroad Appliance Safety Act, the third dealt with loan sharks, and you know, explaining how all of this has to do with commercial activity. Where is that link or that nexus here?
Your Honor, in this case, it is the act of traveling. It is the first two Lopez prongs, if you will. I would submit that those are sort of shorthand renditions, not necessarily discrete.
But I'm saying the second Lopez prong that the Supreme Court cases cited all dealt with commercial activities.
Well, the first prong, use of interstate channels of transportation, and the second prong, in this case, are both satisfied by travel in interstate commerce. It's the travel in interstate commerce that Congress was worried about when they looked at the predecessor to SORNA, the Jacob Wetterly Act, and realized that the states had 50 disparate systems for registration with varying degrees of success. The legislative history shows that there are over 100,000 sex offenders who simply failed to register.
Are there any findings that relate in any way at all to trade or commercial activity?
It would be related to trade or commercial activity in the sense of traveling in interstate commerce, in the same sense that a firearm would travel from Bridgeport, Connecticut to Houston or from Costa Mesa, California to Houston. It would be related to interstate commerce in the sense that the sex offenders must get from one jurisdiction to another in some manner. The crux of the legislative history is that it is the travel itself that removes, precisely as Mr. Letourneau did, it removed him from a jurisdiction where he was a known registered sex offender, Colorado, to a jurisdiction where he was an unknown entity, Virginia. And then he traveled from Virginia to Tennessee, where he not only was prosecuted for failure to register on the basis of his Colorado conviction, he reoffended by molesting two more children. And then, when he was released from confinement in Tennessee, he traveled in interstate commerce to Texas, where he immediately assumed an alias name and a fake date of birth to further conceal his identity and further disguise the fact that he was a registered sex offender now from Colorado and from Tennessee both. And as to the, if I could backtrack just a second, as to the notice requirement, Judge Owen, I believe your question, didn't he admit that he knew he had to register? Deputy U.S. Marshal Bottomley testified that she interviewed Mr. Letourneau on August the 28th, the day after he was arrested. He said at that time he knew that he had to register, but he did not know how long he had to register, which, of course, would be in direct contravention with the printed information that he'd gotten from Colorado, the printed information that he'd gotten from Tennessee, and the oral information that he had gotten from Mr. Sperling before he left Tennessee, and, of course, the information that he would have gotten from his probation officer in Tennessee had he bothered to contact her. That appears in the record at 622 through 624 and 628. Having cited Gould, five of the other circuits have already addressed the Commerce Clause issue and addressed and basically rejected it. The 4th, 7th, 8th, 10th, and 11th is cited in the brief and in the letter brief. The 4th Circuit in Gould cites a number of other instances where the Commerce Clause has been used to affect or to reach criminal conduct. Use of interstate commerce to promote a commercial sex act, illegal possession of a firearm, kidnapping, the Hobbs Act, the Mann Act, interstate transportation of stolen property, interstate transportation of stolen motor vehicles.
Yeah, but all those do have a commercial aspect to them, don't they?
They all do have some commercial aspect, but I would respectfully submit there's no substantial difference between the commercial aspect in those cases. There's no substantial difference between the commercial impact of possession of a firearm and travel from Tennessee to Brownsville, Texas.
Well, except there's a lot of trade and trafficking in guns.
There is a lot of trade and trafficking in guns, and in this instance, Congress legitimately used its power under the Commerce Clause to reach the evil of sex offenders who were required to register under a disparate patchwork of 50 state systems and try to provide some coherent national overarching control of the registration and the access of the public to registration on the part of sex offenders. Going back to the Commerce Clause. Also, of course, the statute in this instance requires knowing conduct. I believe Judge Owen asked about Morrison. Morrison, unless I'm mistaken, had no mens rea requirement. That was the problem, or at least one of the problems.
What about this argument that knowing means you had to know you were violating the U.S. statute, not just that you knew you had to register and you didn't do it, regardless of where the source of that duty came from?
I would respectfully submit that that would be an overbroad reading of Flores-Figueroa. This plain structure of the statute shows that knowingly refers to knowingly traveling in interstate commerce and traveling in interstate commerce and then knowingly either failing to register or failing to update registration. He knew, and as I discussed, Mr. Letourneau is hard pressed to make the notice argument under any circumstances because he had abundant personal
knowledge. So if he registered after 5 days, which would be timely under Tennessee but not under SORNA, you would view that as perhaps a different case.
That would be a tremendously different case, Your Honor. As I said, there are timelines that range from 3 days to 10 days because Mr. Letourneau is, after all, a repeat offender. The fact of the matter is he didn't register, period. He was released.
He actually did the opposite. He went out and took on an assumed name and tried to hide.
That is precisely right, Your Honor, and I would, of course, note parenthetically that the alias name Paul Rutherford or Pablo Rutherford does not correspond to any of the 21 other alias names listed in the PSR in this case. He not only took on an alias name, as he explained to Deputy Marshal Bottomley, he also took on the birth date used by the real Mr. Rutherford, who apparently was his cellmate back in Tennessee.
Is Are you making the argument that there is evidence from which the jury could have found he knew of the federal requirements?
He knew that it's a clear violation of a known legal duty. He knew that he had to register as a sex offender.
Somewhere under some law, but that's not the equivalent of knowing what your time frames are under federal law. I mean, Judge Haynes writes is a good point. Let's suppose he's within the 5 days under some state law, but the federal law is 3 days. He could still be prosecuted.
That would be a completely different question.
Why is it different?
Because there was no registration at all here.
Let's say he registered, but he missed it by 2 days. He could still be prosecuted technically.
That would be a much closer question. He might be prosecuted under one of the state statutes.
Why couldn't he be prosecuted under SORNA for registering past the time required?
In theory, he could be, but it would be he could present to the jury the argument that he had registered timely under the state. And then he would have a much better notice argument. In this case, his notice argument is eviscerated by the fact that he never tried to register.
That's my question to you. Are you saying there's evidence in this record from which the jury could reasonably infer that he knew of the federal requirement? Are you saying it doesn't matter whether he knew of the federal requirement or not?
No, he did not know of the federal requirement. He had unqualified knowledge, unquestionable knowledge, that he had to register under the state, under at least three different state statutes, because he was prosecuted in Colorado and Virginia and Tennessee. He admitted that he had knowledge after he was arrested. There is no showing in the record that he knew that he had to register under the federal statute. But with regard to the argument that the Tennessee state statute has a substantially different opinion, a different punishment, I would note that...
You're talking about time limits. Can he be prosecuted under SORNA? Let's say he registers on day five, and SORNA says day three. Can he be prosecuted?
In theory, he could be prosecuted because his registration is not timely.
There's no evidence that he knew of this federal requirement. Does he have to know the federal requirement or not?
He does not. He simply has to have knowledge that he was obligated to register as a sex offender, and that then, of course, we have to prove that he knowingly failed to register, or in this case, he failed to update his registration, since he was actually registered.
So the time requirement's irrelevant?
No, the time requirement would vary from state to state. As to SORNA, the time requirement would be an element of the offense. We would have to show that he failed to meet the SORNA time requirement.
Under my hypothetical, he did fail to meet it. He registered on day five instead of day three.
All right. Then yes, he could be prosecuted under SORNA if he had missed the.
And would you have to prove that he knew it was 3 days instead of five?
I believe that we would.
Why is that? If the regulation was enforced before he traveled, why wouldn't he be
charged
with knowledge of what the law was?
Well, under Cheek, obviously, he would be charged with knowing what the law was. In this particular instance, he would also be charged with knowing what the law was, since he had actual knowledge. So his hypothetical registration would be a moot point. He was informed before he left Tennessee that he should register within 10 days under Tennessee law. He was also informed.
The government has to prove that he knew he was violating SORNA in order to be prosecuted under the statute?
No, we only have to prove that he traveled in interstate, that he was required to register as a sex offender, that he traveled in interstate commerce, and that he knowingly failed to register or knowingly failed to update his registration. In this case, knowingly failed to update his registration with the state of Tennessee.
Okay. That doesn't answer the question on the time. He can comply with the letter of the Tennessee law and still be in violation of SORNA. Can't he?
As to the time limit.
Yes, as to the timing. So can the government prosecute him or not? And if so, what do they have to prove?
In theory, we could. As a practical matter, we would not had he registered. Here, there simply was no registration. That would be a different case.
We're asking what the proof requirements are under the statute. What's the best case law you have? Can under that case where he complied with Tennessee law but was still in violation of SORNA, what would the government have to prove to obtain a conviction?
That he was that he had committed offense which qualified him as a sex offender, that he knowingly traveled and that he traveled in interstate commerce, and that he knowingly failed to register or update his registration within the time period.
So you would have to prove that he registered, even though he registered on day 10, he knew he should have registered on day 3.
I believe under that fact, that set of facts, we would, but again, there was no registration here. But as a practical matter, had he registered in a timely manner under any of these state statutes, in all probability, he would not have been prosecuted. He was prosecuted because there was no registration for any, for
obvious reasons. I mean, your point is that our hypotheticals are not this case, but obviously we're being asked to write about something that other people will read for future cases, so that's why we're exploring that.
I understand. I'm almost out of time. If the court has any other questions, I'd be glad to address them. Otherwise, thank you
very much, Mr. Berry. Ms. Landau?
There are a couple of points with respect to the purpose of SORNA that I feel like I need to clarify in light of the government's argument. There is no commerce link between the registry and interstate commerce. The purpose of SORNA is not to regulate the travel of sex offenders. The stated purpose of SORNA is to create that registry, which is purely intrastate, non-commercial conduct. And to point to the travel, which is only contained in 18 U.S.C. 2250, it's sort of the tail wagging the dog. That is a tiny piece of a big legislation. The purpose is the registry, not punishing people for failing to register. That is only an enforcement provision. There's no travel link to the registry.
But here there was actual travel. So setting aside your facial challenge, let's talk about an as-applied challenge.
Okay. There is travel here, and I looked at footnote 5 that you mentioned, Judge Owen, and I think it actually works in my favor. The discussion in footnote 5 is of section 40221A, of the Violence Against Women Act. It creates a federal criminal remedy to punish interstate crimes of abuse, including crimes committed against spouses or intimate partners during interstate travel, and crimes committed by spouses or intimate partners who cross state lines to continue the abuse. So there you have misuse of the channel for the purpose of abuse. And here there is no for the purpose of. You can travel without the purpose.
Setting aside for the purpose piece for the moment, how is that conduct any relate to commerce or trade any more than sex offenders? I mean, sex offenders beating with children versus beating your spouse.
Well, there is the use of that travel for the purpose.
So the only distinction is for the purpose.
That is the main distinguishing factor. And here there's a registration requirement. And the registration has zero link or effect on interstate commerce. Even if you aggregated all the registrations nationally, there's still no effect on interstate commerce. You can argue that if you aggregate all this abuse, there is an effect on interstate commerce. I don't know that that would survive, but one could at least make that argument.
I'm sorry, what is the effect of on interstate commerce of someone traveling from, you know, Texarkana, Arkansas to Texarkana, Texas to beat their spouse?
Well, you have the interference with that person's livelihood.
Person being beaten?
Yes. But primarily, I don't want to rest on that.
Maybe not. I don't know.
Maybe, maybe not. I agree with you. Maybe, maybe not. The primary is the misuse of the channel. We don't have the misuse of the channel here. There's never been
a channel in a place like Texarkana. Might be you walk across the street. It's not, you're not getting on a train or plane or even an automobile. There are places in the country where you can cross state lines by walking. Now, obviously, Brownsville, Texas, to wherever in Tennessee in one of them, unless you're a pretty good walker, but Texarkana, Texas, and Arkansas, or name any other border town like that. So I guess I'm not understanding in the abused spouse situation why that's any different in terms of the instrumentality, because the instrumentality could be your feet if you're talking about just how do you get from point A to point B.
Well, you could argue that that's necessary and proper to prevent the larger crime. You might have some specific crimes that don't have a particular interstate commerce effect, but when you get on a plane, you get in a car, those sorts of things, you can say that really is in the interstate channel. Here, you don't have to be misusing the channel ever. There's no requirement of that. And I think if you look at the Child Support Recovery Act, the statute prohibiting possession of machine guns, the Hobbs Act, the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, the Interstate Domestic Violence Act, which we've covered, the Murder for Hire statute, travel for purpose of engaging in sexual act with a minor, they all involve intentional misuse of the channel when that second prong has been relied upon, or the first prong has been relied upon. When the second prong has been relied upon, there's been a distinct commercial aspect to it. For example, in the Child Support Recovery Act, in Bailey, 115 F3rd 1222, it wasn't enough that the parties were diverse, that one party had traveled interstate to evade a custody obligation. It was the fact that there was this debt, this commerce that would move, that was being prevented from moving by the evasion of that debt. It's not enough that there's just interstate movement. There has to be some commerce if you're going to rely on the second prong.
Okay, thank you very much. We have your argument. And